Welcome to the panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass. Here's today's moderator, Sean Kelly.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. Today's cybersecurity executives have an enormous responsibility. We have moved from the conventional data center model to a dynamic and multi-tiered cloud environment with servers, applications, and data spread across the world. It used to be enough to protect an organization with network security, local antiviruses, and a perimeter firewall. Now that has exploded into an array of solutions like intrusion detection systems, security incident and event management tools, spam filtering, encryption, and many other solutions that need to be installed, integrated, and managed. The complexity of cloud environments and mobile technologies have cybersecurity professionals developing new ways to tackle these issues. Organizations need cybersecurity that provides complete visibility, relative intelligence, and the ability to scale to create a comprehensive view of their security posture. This show will explore how an organization matures, uses threat intelligence, creates a comprehensive view of its cybersecurity posture, and employs contextual intelligence in the cyber battlefield. Let's break that down with my guest today, Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services; Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer at the Department of Homeland Security; Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity at the Government Accountability Office; and Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer, Looking Glass. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
So, you know, I'll start with somewhat of an easy question, but kind of a loaded question. Is it fair to say that today's data is infinitely harder to secure than it was in the past? Alan, let me start with you. I said it was loaded.
Well, I think infinitely is obviously not quantifiable, but I do think that data, just based on the breaches that are occurring, is becoming easier, or would appear to be easier to be stolen. So from a perspective of defending data, I would say it's gotten harder. Because data can be in many different places. The nature of the network has changed, where data is stored. The ability to even identify what data is relevant to protect versus not relevant to your business. So I think it's definitely gotten harder, but I think that is an opportunity for network defenders to really apply new approaches.
Shane, what do you think?
I'm not sure I'd say hard. I agree. I don't think you can quantify harder. I think really what's happening is you're seeing the threat landscape change. And threats that we used to have are really not a big deal anymore. I mean, you used to have more physical threats. You know, you're worried about your data centers getting hit by an earthquake or a tornado or something like that. Now, of course, with cloud technologies, you don't worry about those sorts of things. You're more distributed networking. We're far more resilient. But at the same time, we have a new threat environment that is ever expanding and ever increasing and ever seamless, in the sense that, you know, there's a lot more unknowns that we don't always necessarily aren't right in front of necessarily, whether that's, you know, phishing hit that we're going to hit with phishing on the user side, whether that's APTs coming at us that we're not, you know, completely unaware of and get caught off guard on, or their hardware attacks. Which we're seeing quite a few of lately. So there's all the threat landscape, I think, is really what's changing. I don't know if it's necessarily harder, it's just different.
Matt, from setting a strategy at DHS, what do you see?
Well, the capabilities are also advanced in defending the data. We used to have traditional approaches to defending the systems that the data was on. And at best, you know, then we would encrypt the data at rest, we'd encrypt the data in transit, but it was always decrypted in processing and we'd have to share that data deliberately with others, and often in unprotected manners or less than the way that we would want. So cloud has actually enabled portable protection of data to be, I think, more effective and accomplished more easily than it was in the past as well. We just have so much data, and it's flowing to so many different places that it has to change how we protect the data in order to possibly be able to approach solving the problem. And I think that to all of the points that have been made that I concur, I think it's about leveraging the new capabilities in the new threat landscape and being able to protect the most important data first is probably the way that we will solve that solution most effectively.
And I think we'll talk more about that during this show. Greg, you have a little bit different role than the other panel members today. Can you expound on your role at GA?
Sure. Rather than an operator or an implementer like my colleagues up here, I am an auditor. So I go in and evaluate how well agencies are actually implementing the new capabilities that Matt talked about, and addressing the challenges, the new threats that have been discussed. And that's something that we do on a regular basis. We have been reporting on information security, cybersecurity issues as a government-wide high-risk area since 1997. And so it's been over two decades. And many of the same types of vulnerabilities that agencies experience exist since that time. And so much of, in terms of being able to say whether it's harder or not, I think I would agree that the threat landscape has changed. There are new capabilities which, if effectively implemented, can help agencies better manage the risk associated with their cybersecurity.
So Matt mentioned it. Some say by 2020, the average cost of a data breach is expected to reach more than $150 million. But what I used to see in the agencies was it's hard to get to that place where people will say, this is the most important data to secure. You know, what we get a lot from our business lines is, I need everything. You know, Shane, have you had any luck with getting customers to have those hard conversations?
Actually, we've had some, and I'll explain how. That is a hard conversation to have because there are legally defined definitions of what data is important. You know, sensitive information, PII, sensitive PII, that sort of thing. That's easy. That's a walk in the park. It's when you start talking about stuff that's on the fringes of that. Is it really that sensitive? Is it, what levels of protection does it have? And then you start getting into this, well, if we're going to do it for this, we might as well do it for everything. Cloud actually enables that. I mean, it really truly does. I mean, I wouldn't say you don't have to worry about it. That's not the right phrase I would use. But it does allow you a greater flexibility into protecting the information. So it's not that we shouldn't be having those conversations. We should, because it's important. And not only that, it goes back to how much data we should keep in archives and how much we should have available on hand, because the more data you accumulate, the greater your chances are of a problem. Whereas if we were really due diligent about, you know, having, okay, this data is 5 years old, we no longer need it, we're allowed to delete it or get rid of it or archive it or do something different with it, we need better strategies wrapped around that. I don't know if we always do, I wouldn't speak for government-wide, but I know we don't always do the best job of managing data over a lifetime. You know, how long do we have to maintain this? What can we do with it after the fact? You know, we were a heavily paper-based agency for a long, long, long time. Mm-hmm. And now we've made this huge leap into the electronic world, and we're still sort of adjusting to that. We were really good at managing paper, and paper's safe. Nobody hacks paper, ever. I've had the argument where, hey, you know, we can go back to paper. Paper's good. I mean, I understand it kills trees, but still, it's cheaper in some weird, bizarre way. But, you know, and because it's easy to manage, it's a risk reducer. Whereas electronic data, well, now we have a lot more risk. You know, we're putting ourselves out there in a bigger way. So I think I can speak for my agency, that we have done, we do our very best in terms of categorizing that data and making sure we understand it and making sure we try to figure out a life cycle for it. And I think that's really the key, is figuring out your life cycle for your information, because you don't want to keep it forever. That's really not a good strategy. And I think that's been the strategy for a very, very long time. Unfortunately, the one downside to cloud is data storage is cheap. You know, you can put things in Amazon's Glacier for pennies on the terabyte in some respects. You can keep that stuff forever. Do you really need it? I think it's the question that needs to get asked. I just don't think we do a great job at that yet.
Greg, you look at a lot of agencies.
Yes.
What do you see?
Well, I think I agree that the cloud is certainly an opportunity to help secure data that's out there, but it's also does not allow agencies to say, well, it's a cloud service provider's responsibility for securing the information. It's still up to the agency to make sure that the cloud service provider is adequately protecting that information. And so there needs to be mechanisms in place for that to happen. And just because it's out of sight doesn't mean that it's out of mind with respect to security. We have found that the security over data at most of the agencies we go to needs to be dramatically improved. And it's not just GAO, it's also the inspectors general. The inspectors general at the various agencies, at least 18 out of the 24 CFO Act agencies, which are the major federal departments and agencies, cite that their agency's information security program is not effective. And so there are a number of reasons for this, and those are issues that we continue to find in the work that we do. And the work we do can expand across the entire federal government, but we also go in and drill down and look at the security programs at specific agencies. And what we often find is that agencies are not taking some of the basic security control safeguards that they should be implementing on a consistent basis. There are almost invariably pockets of excellence within every agency. But when you look across the entire agency, there are areas that are traditionally not being secured to the extent that they should have, just through the inconsistent implementation of the security controls that they should be implementing.
Matt, let me ask you, are you seeing agencies have those hard conversations with the cloud providers from the CISO's office at DHS? Greg Tuhill and I used to talk about this all the time, is that, you know, you should be asking to make sure that you can answer some of those messages. And I don't know if a lot of agencies feel empowered to have that conversation with AWS or Azure or Google to say, hey, I want to see how you're doing this and what your controls you're putting in place. Have you seen that?
Well, so the hyperscale cloud providers are sometimes difficult to go toe-to-toe with, even from large other organizations.
Agreed.
I think the only federal-wide FISMA program to have success over the amount of time that it's been placed is FedRAMP has actually been able to, I think, lift the industry there a little bit. Has been able to, you know, kind of definitely provide to government a level of visibility of what cloud service providers, including the hyperscale providers, are doing to secure federal information. The visibility that the federal government gets into those security approaches, it surpasses any of their other customers. Clouds that are leveraging other clouds don't have the level of visibility into the security that's being trusted that the government has. We're still taking a traditional approach and trying to tailor it to cloud needs. And that kind of meets in the middle. It's a compromise approach. There's innovation that can continue to be done there that I think will benefit both federal government and the cloud industry and the commercial providers. There are certain types of system and impact where government requirement is maybe even a little bit above or beyond best practice and kind of commercial standards. Those tend to be the areas where there's sometimes struggle, but also I think improvement made with the cloud service providers in meeting the federal standard. FedRAMP has even, from what I'm understanding, being kind of adopted a de facto standard for much of the financial industry. Okay. For high impact data types. But it's one piece of the problem. Okay. I think, and kind of to echo some of the comments have already been made, that the federal use of cloud is still in its development. We're still building the expertise we need to do it well and properly. I don't think that most of the problems we've had to date have been around capability or even the services that have been provided as much as they've been around configuration, rigor in process and management, or even just architectural problems. And sometimes the inexperience is what has been getting us more than the capability that's provided.
No, I agree. Alan, you know, Greg also mentioned there's pockets of excellence in some agencies that just isn't implemented throughout the agencies, but then we also have the large agencies that probably do a much better job than some of the less resourced, smaller agencies. What are you seeing across the sectors? What are you seeing as agencies bringing or organizations bringing together best practices to try to get better at the data security and threat intelligence?
So I would say, to answer that question, I think I go back to part of your earlier question, which was how do we get ahead of adversaries? And I think the agencies and organizations that are being successful in that are ones that are looking at a more holistic approach to defense. So understanding the adversary and putting themselves to a certain extent in their shoes and looking at the breadth of what an adversary looks at. An adversary is not going to focus on one part of your organization. They're going to look at where can they exploit, you know, to the vulnerabilities. You know, they go after those to begin to then pivot to other systems. Ultimately, their objectives may be completely different from where they start. So they think, I think, much more broadly about how they attack an organization to achieve their objective. I think organizations that are defending need to think very similarly, think much more holistically. Don't just focus on one aspect of the network or one aspect of data security or user protection, you know, multi-factor authentication. All of these approaches are important, but ultimately you need to think about how they all connect and how they ultimately are all orchestrated so that as a defender, you're able to orchestrate and have a response in a much more coordinated manner than individual siloed approaches.
Let's talk about more of that when we come back. My guests today are Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security, Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity, Government Accountability Office, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer, Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly, on a panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Looking Glass Cyber Solutions offers unified threat protection against your business's digital risk. The Looking Glass portfolio is purposefully designed to address digital risk at every stage of the cyber attack cycle. Their outside-in view of threats helps organizations determine the risks that matter most to them, not just what's trending in the news. For unrivaled visibility, response, and management of your digital business risk, visit LookingGlassCyber.com. That's LookingGlassCyber.com.
Welcome back to the panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. My guests today are Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security, Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity, Government Accountability Officer, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer of Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly. So before we went on break, we talked a little bit about organizations, agencies looking at their cybersecurity program holistically. Shane, I'll go with you. I don't think there's any time you don't want to look at it holistically, but there's only so many resources, so many things that you can tackle at once. How do we get there?
Yeah, if you're not looking at it holistically, you're failing from the very get-go. I think the first, you know, if money was infinite and resources were infinite, obviously tools and people and everything would solve some problems, but it doesn't solve all. And nor do tools solve all problems. You know, they do help, and you have to be very conscious of that, but you can't get complacent on your tools because just... I was on a panel one time where I heard someone actually make the statement, oh, well, I've got cloud, I've got tools, I'm good. I know everything that's going on. And I thought, wow, I don't envy him. Because at some point he's going to learn where his blind spots are. As someone, USCIS has been in cloud for, 10 years now. We're about 90% as an agency in cloud. So we're heavy cloud users. We've done a lot. We've had a lot of experience with it. And in terms of a holistic approach, the real problem for us, and it's less so now, but was in the early years of as we were transitioning, is that hybrid model where you were still on-prem and you needed all your on-prem sort of tools and stuff. At the same time, you're making this huge leap into the cloud technology world and all the challenges and benefits, both, that come with that. And then how do you balance out that? And that's where that holistic approach has to come. Really what it boils down to, at least for me, is three things. You need all the right resources, and that involves having, you know, people who understand cloud technology on the incident response side, on the security engineering side, as well as the governance side. Those are all really key areas, because that sort of core group of individuals with those sets of skills and experience are going to be able to bring to bear that holistic approach to cloud technologies, as well as all your other on-prem versus non-prem. And, you know, so that's, to me, that, you know, taking a holistic approach, yeah, that is by definition your security program. Really what that involves, though, is getting the right people in the right places with the right knowledge and the right skills, because that's what's going to drive that. And I don't think necessarily what works really well for one agency is applicable across the board. I think there's always lessons to be learned. But really, you know, your security program should be focused in on how your agency does business, which means you've got to have a good relationship with your business partners, the people who are actually driving the need for applications and data sharing and all that. You need to understand the reasoning behind that, because if you're stopping mission, well, you're really, yeah, you may be secure, but your agency's not going anywhere either. So you've got to have that balance. And I think that's part of that holistic approach. It's not just about the security. It's about understanding the mission as well and how the security can help meet that mission.
Greg?
Right. I agree with everything that Shane just mentioned, because it is a fact that you have to have that balance and also the collaboration, coordination between those individuals responsible for cyber risk within the organization and the other major risk associated with the enterprise risk management of the entire organization. A couple colleagues of mine, Nick Marinos and Marisol Cruz-Kane, just issued a report last month that showed where agencies still have room for improvement, particularly in that risk management, developing a risk management strategy and the collaboration between the cyber risk portion of an organization with the enterprise risk management across the entire enterprise. The other thing that I think is really key, and it's necessary across pretty much all agencies in order to effect the type of performance that Shane just talked about, is making sure that the senior leaders, the head of each agency and senior management are fully on board and recognizing that cybersecurity is an important element that needs to be addressed throughout the organization. If you don't have top management support, you're not likely to get the resources and the attention that they need to bring to bear in order to be effective in implementing security across the enterprise.
Matt, there was a lot of talk about people. And we have a very low employment rate today in this country. Are we seeing, from a cybersecurity standpoint, the ability to attract those type of people to government service, or at least to the environments in which we can bring them in on a contract?
Well, so people is the right answer to nearly all of the questions. We need better people. We need more better people. And that's not just government.
Okay.
But it's a bigger challenge potentially for government. That government has been trying to develop innovative solutions to be able to compete for an increasingly scarce resource. I think the last industry numbers that I saw was targeting 2 million job shortage in cybersecurity in the next couple of years. And so for government to be able to get the best or the good enough when everyone else is clamoring and throwing their resources and their weight at fighting over those same skilled individuals, I think it's going to be a challenge for everyone. The reality is that you need people who can deliver the balance that Shane was talking about to that holistic program, mm-hmm. to be able to bring the expertise for the things that you're trying to accomplish. And maybe those things aren't cutting edge yet, but maybe that's the direction that you're needing them to take you. You need them to be able to design and deploy and develop the solutions that are going to buy down risk, that are going to make the biggest improvements for the resources that we have. You need people who are going to be able to wield those tools in expert ways that also makes our defenses dynamic and appropriate to the attack and the threat environment that we're in. Our adversaries are customers of the same tools that we buy deliberately. And so, you know, being able to ensure that our defense is different than what comes out of the box and better than what comes out of the box is a critical element to, I think, being able to do what needs to be done.
Totally agree. Alan, we've discussed it. We're seeing advances in technologies that make networks themselves more dynamic, more volatile. How do cybersecurity tools and platforms need to adapt to address these evolving needs? But also, we just heard, 2 million person gap in professionals. Can tools help us with that gap?
Well, most definitely, I would say they can definitely help. I would say finding effective people or experienced people in security is actually probably always going to be a challenge. So
making those individuals that you do have more effective, more efficient at achieving the objectives of a security organization, I think tools can assist. But to Shane's point, it's much more than just tools. It's actually how you operationalize them, the workflow that you use within the organization. So it's a holistic approach. I would say, you know, in terms of technology, one of the challenges with adoption of new networking technology, adoption of cloud virtualization, oftentimes, which sadly is still, I would say, a reflection on how networks evolve, is they don't think about how security should be applied to some of these new technologies. So applying a more agile technology approach to security and making sure that it's built into when you do move to the cloud or when you adopt new virtualization technologies, either when and how you build applications, for example, micro-segmentation, services-based infrastructure. All of these approaches are very agile and dynamic, but oftentimes security is an afterthought. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that dynamic so that security is just part of the discussion. It's not an afterthought where you apply it afterwards. So really building it in so that you can apply security in the most effective manner. So just bolting on a piece of old security infrastructure to a dynamic environment is not effective. And we need to change that going forward.
Shane?
I couldn't agree more. One of the things I have to agree with Greg as well, you know, the implementation of risk management in a new modern cloud world is critical. You know, my agency did that whether we liked it or not, kicking and screaming. When we a previous CIO of ours, Mark Schwartz, he really was a big advocate of this. He really pushed it and drove it, and you know, to us all kicking and screaming into this new world. Risk management, you know, is a different way of looking at the problems of security. Instead of focusing on, you know, every little nuance there is, you focus on the things that are that place you at the greatest risk, and then look for mitigations and solutions around that. It does take in that more holistic sort of approach to it, and if done correctly, and stress the if done correctly, it does get built into all aspects of your, you know, whether it's your development pipelines, whether it's your networking engineering teams, you know, they all become their own versions of security professionals. I think critical, though, one of the key aspects, especially when you're talking about cloud technologies for any security program, and something I neglected to mention, is the importance of security teams having their own development teams. I was at an Amazon conference not too long ago, and the driving point was this quote they kept putting up, which, you know, if infrastructure is code, then security is code. Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you, I mean, I'm fortunate that I have under me several development teams. Those are what enable those cloud security tools. Those are the things that drive the integrations and the automations that we need. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, terabytes upon terabytes of data being flowing in via logs and you know, application logging and desktops and everything else that we get sources of information from, it's an overwhelming amount. There's no way a single entity or, you know, even a group of people could ingest or do anything useful with that information. It's only through the uses of integration with other tools as well as analytics, machine learning, and dare I even say artificial intelligence, that you can begin to wrap your hands around that, because the amount of flow of information is just overwhelming to even get to that point. So I really think those that the, you know, the points these gentlemen have made have just been critical to the overall success.
Yeah, just to add on to Shane's point, I think the development of security, there's two aspects, two mindsets, and we've seen this in our organization. You have developers who are used to building software, mm-hmm. who don't necessarily have a significant experience in security. They obviously have security experience because of what they do, but a security mindset operations, somebody who's used to actually protecting organizations, they may not have the coding skills or the architectural skills to develop software. So harnessing those two aspects in a team effectively is a really important thing, because you need the people who understand the latest techniques and technologies to deploy software in an agile environment. But you need that expertise to understand, okay, what is the software doing? What is it looking for? How important is historical context? What additional data am I missing or do I need to be able to actually make a conscious decision to act on this data? So that security mindset incorporated with a development capability is incredibly powerful.
I agree. And I would say that earlier Greg mentioned since the late 90s, you know, cybersecurity has been a high risk area. I know when I started studying cybersecurity in the early 2000s, we had that discussion. Security can't be an afterthought. Greg, are you seeing a progression? Things that Shane are doing, that's exactly what we need to be doing. Are you seeing that across other agencies? DHS obviously has their act together, but are other agencies also doing some things like Shane's saying? Are you seeing any of that in the trends?
Well, I think to a large extent, we're seeing where more people are getting involved in recognizing information security, cybersecurity as a key element of an agency's operations and development, particularly among some of the senior leadership. But it's still not where it needs to be in terms of making sure that the appropriate resources are being granted to address these across an agency and across agencies consistently. Now, make no mistake about it, federal government spending much more now on cybersecurity than it ever has in the past. I think in fiscal year 2018, it spent about $14 to $15 billion. And that was on average about 14 or 15% of an agency's IT budget on spending on cybersecurity activities. Prior years was about 8 to 9% of IT budgets were being spent on cybersecurity. So I think, you know, the need for agencies and indeed the developers to consider and address security during the development is getting more play, but I think more still needs to be done.
Are we seeing, and this might be a hard question to answer, are we seeing with that investment that the ball's moving at the same pace, or are we playing catch up in some ways?
I think it's both. You know, I think we're making improvements, but we're not in a static environment. The threats are changing, the technologies are changing, business practices are changing, where agencies are giving additional access to external parties in order to deliver services or to collect and provide information. And so the threats are constantly changing, and it's still important to remember that even with some of the new technologies and that, it still requires basic security practices in order to be better protect an agency's information. You know, for example, over 39%, I think, of the incidents that agencies reported to the to DHS for fiscal year 2018 dealt with improper usage of systems and information. Or loss and theft of information. So some of these very basic policies and attributes tend to increase the threats and the vulnerabilities of agencies in protecting their information. Other aspects too is 33% of the incidents dealt with web-based type of and email types of threats and attack vectors through which these incidents were reported. That is an area where the federal government is making, I think, better headway in trying to address that issue through some of the binding operational directives that DHS has issued, as well as other initiatives that DHS through CDM is taking a part in. And that's something that could, if effectively implemented, will help agencies protect that information.
And I'll come back to you after the break. My guests today are Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security, Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity, Government Accountability Office, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer, Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly, on the panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Looking Glass Cyber Solutions offers unified threat protection against your business's digital risk. The Looking Glass portfolio is purposefully designed to address digital risk at every stage of the cyber attack cycle. Their outside-in view of threats helps organizations determine the risks that matter most to them, not just what's trending in the news. For unrivaled visibility, response, and management of your digital business risk, visit LookingGlassCyber.com. That's LookingGlassCyber.com.
Welcome back to the panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass on the Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. My guests today are Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security, Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity, Government Accountability Office, Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly. Before we went on break, we were talking about the advances in the investment in cybersecurity, and you wanted to make a comment on open source.
Yeah, this is Alan speaking. but one of the key things I think Greg was making a point of was really, you know, how do we raise the bar against vulnerabilities across organizations? And I think looking at some of the benefits of an open source approach to leveraging either code or security capabilities, such as, like, for example, the Bro community or Zeek community is a very active community. Leveraging those types of communities to help the industry to improve you know, capability as well as security, I think is something we should consider. I do think that, you know, as we were discussing during the break, there are some issues around supply chain risk by going that route. But I think, you know, every organization should weigh both the pros and cons of looking at open source to further improve their security capabilities.
No, I totally understand. Back to Alan. The threat intelligence, there's a lot of talk about it and how it can help organizations. What is threat intelligence?
there's a lot of things that can go into threat intelligence. Ultimately, it's about data that can be used to help protect the organization. So there's no shortage of data, as we've previously talked about. I think the key challenge is what data is relevant to securing your organization. So for example, how can intelligence make that data more effective and more useful in your organization? So it could be as simple as what type of actors are performing certain types of campaigns, certain TTPs, certain behaviors that ultimately can help inform or instruct your response to those aspects. It could be as basic as a technical indicator saying there's known C2s or certain C domains that you want to watch out for. If there's any communication with those things, then alert at a minimum. But intelligence can be considered a much broader aspect than that. Think about intelligence that informs you about your organization as a whole, you know, individuals, potentially public individuals who are potentially targets, brand awareness, information about potentially people using, setting up domains to then attack your organization. What information can you learn about that? There's many different aspects of intelligence, but fundamentally it's about focusing your defensive efforts based on what that intelligence tells you.
And Matt? Cool.
Yeah, so there's this interesting gap, I think, between the threat intelligence, which is absolutely critical to our security operations, and the actual security operations that we do at the scale of the enterprise of DHS or federal government or others. And the threat intel guys have tons of data, and they've got tons of really genius people, and they've got the secret sauce that cooks that down into really valuable summaries and things that my security operations teams can do to educate themselves and to kind of bring that information into their operations. But then they've also are tooling some of that. And very often what we get is, you know, data points on things that are probably good versus things that are probably bad. Or we even sometimes get a risk score, right? This is an 8, and what does the 8 mean? Depends wildly on who your provider is. But the challenge we have with that in operationalizing it is that what we really need, we don't need to go get our own group of geniuses and our own secret sauce and our own mass amounts of data. We've got plenty of data. But in order for me to contextualize that 8 in my environment, I really need the bit of data that went into calculating that 8. And there's some trade secret challenges in exposing that we haven't figured out how to overcome. But if I had those data elements and could put that in context of my own data and my own analysis, then I can start identifying whether there's a threat to systems at the southern border, or whether there's a threat to a particular executive that I have, or whether there's a threat to a location and a time that I might know that we've got either a particularly sensitive event going to be happening, or a particularly impactful travel that's going to be happening. And that being able to contextualize that for my needs is a gap in the space of threat intelligence that we haven't figured out how to overcome yet. But I would love for the industry and the mission owners to be able to get together and innovate in that space.
Alan, what's your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree. I do think that providing the context around that score is vital because, as you rightly say, a score means nothing to the consumer until you contextualize what that score means to the organization. I do think that providing supporting information that came up with that score sometimes is challenging because sometimes it's based on sensitive either collection capability or information that ultimately you don't want to relay necessarily all of the aspects. So being able to relay enough context so that it's useful is a something that, you know, our organization definitely is working on. But I totally agree. You know, I think one of the challenges with scores is another aspect is that it doesn't necessarily tell you the how critical the threat is either. So a score might represent, oh, this thing's really bad, but is it really bad in my environment? Or is it really impactful in my environment? So we need to evolve our approach to how scoring is actually done in the first place so that those additional nuanced but important details are actually called out. So maybe multiple aspects of scoring, which I think, you know, CVSS, for example, tries to address some of that. Some of the updates to CVSS version 3 are actually improving some of that. But I think we still have work to do in the industry to improve that, to get to you what you're requesting, Matt.
Yeah, another topic that we hear thrown around a lot around the industry is zero trust. I know DHA is doing some things with zero trust. Is it really practical to deploy?
So I had a fairly interesting conversation lately with a vendor that will remain unnamed, saying that this was one area where the government's gotten ahead of industry.
Outstanding.
And they wanted us to help them understand what we wanted them to build so we could buy it from them. And so zero trust now is kind of thrown on a whole lot of things as a marketing term and to try and, you know, churn your business. But I don't believe that it's a destination. You know, we've got, it's a principle now. We've got a conceptual architecture that we're working to objectives and requirements. But it's the map and not the destination. It's going to change how we design. It's going to change how we connect. It's going to change how we share information. And so the principles of discontinuing our reliance on trust for security decisions, to never trust, to always verify, always authenticate, and always monitor. I think that's a fundamentally a different model that will allow us to radically change our risk postures as we get there, but it's going to be a journey getting there. I think the concepts, the principles, the information we've been able to distill at this point is enough to guide the efforts that we make in the approach that we take to zero trust. But it's not something we can just go buy from anybody who claims to be selling that particular snake oil.
No, agreed. So Shane, you know, outside of your agency, but just in your CISO hat role, does a program have to be really mature to deploy zero trust? Or as we just mentioned, it's a journey, we can do it in increments, but you know, how do we get there?
Well, see, you know, when I first started hearing that term, zero trust, I thought, well, of course, I'm a CISO. I don't trust anybody. So it fits really well. You know, I agree with Matt. This isn't a destination. This isn't something we're going to check a box one day and say, yep, we're done, we're good. It really is about a conceptual architecture and about a way of approaching architecture. And not only that, if you're a cloud agency, if you're an organization that's moved to the cloud, you're already implementing zero trust. You have to. You've now officially, the idea of a boundary, the idea of a perimeter is now officially gone. And you can do things in cloud that you never could have done on-prem. And so zero trust by default becomes sort of your go-to model, whether you like it or not. And so then, you know, what as a security organization, what do you do? What do you have to do to get in front of that? I am very fortunate, CISO, in the sense that I own identity in my agency, meaning the ICAM program that does PIV implementation and all those sorts of things belongs to me. They report to me. I control how and what is done with that. So, yeah, I have an agency that is 99 point, actually, in 3 more days, we will be 100% PIV compliant across the agency of all of our systems, all of our organization will be all based on that. Almost 60% of my organization now, we had to do OSZ, so all of our roles and accesses are done and controlled by our ICAM program. I have a lot of functionality and capability that speak to zero trust. Do I think I'm at the zero trust model level? No, I think we'll always be evolving and iterating towards it. We actually do take an agile approach to even how we do security, and we approach it from the mindset that security, especially in the cloud world, is just too large, too big to take on all at once. So we, again, do risk assessments, and we say, okay, what's at most risk? Where do we have to focus our efforts and limited resources? And that's how we have approached sort of that zero trust model. We didn't get there all at once. We started out trying to get PIV implemented, and then we did single sign-on, and then we made sure all of our systems were single sign-on. Then we went after OSZ. I want to go to cert-based authentications. So there's a model for evolving towards it, but it is in the destination. I think you don't have to be a mature organization to do that. It's really about, okay, what can I do today? What can I do next week? What can I do next month? And just iterate towards that. If you're going to go to cloud, you're going to end up going there regardless. It's just how painful of a process do you want to go through to get there?
Alan, how do organizations start moving towards, using threat intelligence, zero trust? How do organizations move towards getting a comprehensive view? We've talked holistically or comprehensive view of the organization. What do you see in your role as a CTO?
Talk about loaded question. comprehensive view. I would say comprehensive view implies that you actually understand your organization, first of all. And so it sounds like, Shane has a very good handle on his organization, sorry. But the key point is that it's all your networks, all your access, all your applications, all your users, and then layer on top of that your third-party supply chain. So who has access to your networks? Who has access to systems that are not necessarily in your organization? And then what visibility do you have to that? So, it's not unknown to use a third party as a way to attack an organization. So you go after the low-hanging fruit. I think this is another issue that I have with zero trust in terms of, it's great to have authentication and authorization, but what happens if that individual who that is compromised? So that person has now actually got the keys and they're able to do whatever they want because they're actually authorized. So what capabilities do you have to actually detect somebody, or at least somebody who's operating with those credentials, to actually detect their behaviors being abnormal or malicious? So zero trust is absolutely a framework. Completely agree with Shane and Matt, but we need to focus on more what is actually able to provide complete visibility. And don't just assume that just because you know who they are that they're still doing the right thing. So additional capability for visibility as well as analytical behavior is really important.
Well, there are elements of zero trust that cross-cut the areas where you might apply those principles for user, for applications, for devices, for data, for networks. But there's fundamentally visibility and enforcement that needs to occur across all of it. You need to always be able to monitor the insiders and the outsiders. And as that perimeter dissolves, you don't really treat insiders and outsiders particularly differently. You also need to be able to automate and orchestrate across all of the areas. And so being able to determine and be aware of anomalous activity, independent of whether or not they're an authorized user, independent of whether or not you've verified who they are, that they're doing things they shouldn't be doing, are elements to that zero trust model that I do think speak directly to the insider threat, whether it's malicious or whether it's accidental is irrelevant, because you're applying holistically those defenses as if all networks were not yours, all personnel were yours or others or partners or insider or outsider. You really just kind of treat the elements as the elements that you're able to secure around them.
Alan, we have a few seconds left on the show. How does industry help our government partners be the glue. We see a lot of different things as well. GAO sees different sectors. We see different sectors on the industry side. How do we help be the glue? How do we bring the technologies, but also bring the lessons learned from other agencies or other sectors to the government?
Well, I mean, one concrete area is definitely adopting standards that allow sharing of intelligence. We still sadly don't have, I would say, comprehensive use of, for example, Stix and Taxi, which is especially the new version, version 2. I think some of the new standards that are we're starting to look at Looking Glass is a standard around orchestration and playbook, so that we can actually start to define how organizations respond holistically to threats and mitigate threats, and apply that across holistically all of the different networks, endpoints, users, et cetera, but create it in a playbook and then ultimately be able to share that across organizations in a standards-based way. So those are two areas that I think could, if we adopt them fully, would actually significantly benefit everybody.
Well, I agree, and I want to thank all today's guests. Shane Barney, Chief Information Security Officer of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Matt Smith, Senior Advisor to the Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security. Greg Wilshusen, Director, Information Technology and Cybersecurity at Government Accountability Office. Alan Thompson, Chief Technology Officer at Looking Glass. I'm your moderator, Sean Kelly, and you're listening to Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. For more discussion, visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search CyberChat.
Thank you for listening to the panel discussion, Employing Contextual Intelligence in the Cyber Battlefield, sponsored by Looking Glass on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
Looking Glass Cyber Solutions offers unified threat protection against your business's digital risk. The Looking Glass portfolio is purposefully designed to address digital risk at every stage of the cyber attack cycle. Their outside-in view of threats helps organizations determine the risks that matter most to them, not just what's trending in the news. For unrivaled visibility, response, and management of your digital business risk, visit LookingGlassCyber.com. That's LookingGlassCyber.com.